will briefly address some of the key points in his, and also just based on the discussion to date, some of the points have sort of already been addressed, but there are a couple of points arising that he wanted to touch on as well. And then Ms. Panther and I will follow up and will also comment on your offer of thinking about that in terms of as well. Mr. Heath.
Thank you. Good morning. What I was intending to do was sort of just bunny hop through some of the key takeouts from my written evidence rather than regurgitating all of what the discussion's been already, and just highlight a couple of the key points that I think are relevant in terms of the analysis from a retail economic position. I suppose the first key takeaway from the evidence is that the retail market is a dynamic market, and retail stores and trade stores and industrial activities, all their uses need to change and evolve in a dynamic way to remain competitive. And we've seen that quite markedly within the hardware sector itself. We see now around centres where we, 15, 20 years ago, we actually had smaller hardware stores, like Hammer Hardwares and the like, in centres. But they simply, given the changing nature and then the development of Mitre 10s to Mitre 10 megas, and the Bunnings movement to trade supplied like Mitre 10, that those stores are no longer fit for purpose, those small format stores, and they meant that their ability to locate within centres per se, as we traditionally call them, has changed, and they can no longer get the land requirements and what have you. So the last 10 years have seen a significant shift in this particular sector in the way that the goods and services that they offer have been delivered to the market. And Ms. Panther Knight goes on to talk about how some of those changes have been reflected from first generation to second generation plans which can come into play. So, in essence, it means that they have found a great difficulty fitting into centres. In recent years, the only ones I can see that where a trade or building supply store has been located in the centre has normally been right at the front end of the centre when a centre is developed, and the developer or a landlord wants to lease space out, and he may be prepared to do that as at the front end. But it's very rare, and I can't think of an example where a modern large format building and trade supply store has moved into a centre post the establishment of the centre. So there's a subtle difference there. And the ones I'm thinking of there is a centre in Takanini called Southgate. It had a mega 10 moving at the front end, and that's what the balance of the centre is being built around. Subsequently, I think they are wanting to move out of that centre now to a larger store and have a chop hunt for large format. And the other one was in Christchurch, there's Tower Junction, which had the buttons actually right at the front end and was initially developed. And the reason for that shift and the increased size of the store, which I've identified about 5 to 10 times, is a move, a quite specific move towards targeting the trade market, and that's the business-to-business transactions. So we're not talking about just general public shoppers now, we're talking about builders, contractors, subcontractors, construction companies, property management developers, all utilising both Mitre 10 and Bunnings stores more for their trade activity on trade accounts, etc., to compete with the more traditional trade bodies by others such as Carters and Placemakers. And the difference with Placemakers is one of the things that they have the future building accounts in play there. So give them a big backstop. So, but it's important to understand, Queenstown is a high growth state for New Zealand, and the projections are for high growth. So the construction sector is going to be a critical part in delivering that growth, and building and hardware supplies are a vital part of the construction sector. So the demand side for the store type, these store types, are there, and it's going to be crucial to ensure that the growth that's projected actually can be established and can be enabled. So it's a high growth zone. This is the sector to account. And these sectors are going to be filling more of the industrial land supply, quite probably in the high growth sector relevant to others. I then touched base a little bit talking about trade versus distributional effects, and I won't go into that into too much detail because it's, given what I've talked about before, now that these hardware and building supply stores don't locate in centres and very rarely are located in centres, that the actual effects on centres themselves aren't really a relevant consideration because it's simply plausible for them to generate a significant effect. They may generate some minor trade competition effects, but they just simply can't roll over into wider retail distribution effects in the context of the RMA. The land holdings have increased significantly in terms of what they require, and that's part of the reason why it doesn't fit, or it's not a good fit for centres. And also, when we consider the growth for Queenstown, we just don't need to consider trying to have building and trade supplies in commercial land and in centres, but it's also, there's going to be significant growth in more traditional retail stores that need to occupy that land. So you wouldn't want to, from a I suppose planning perspective, but also an urban form perspective, an economic efficiency argument, is to occupy traditional retail land with what you could argue perhaps a fringe or non-fringe activity such as this, a retail activity such as this. So that land available in retail and commercial centres should actually be looked after for more retail-oriented activity rather than activities such as building trade supplies, in my view. And an important part of industrial land demand is this specific sector. So when you look at the demand for industrial land, an important component of that demand is determining the demand generated from not only construction, but the wholesale trade sector, which this is an important part. So if that was not part of and not able to go into industrial zone land, you actually have to remove the wholesale trade element from the demand for industrial land, which would actually lower the industrial land demand quite significantly given the large land holdings these occupy. So it's a quick pro quo type situation where if it's going to be channeled into, or try to be channeled into retail centres, then you need to offset that with the loss of demand for industrial zone land in the industrial land demand projections for the district. So, I think that probably covers most of the critical things. And I just saw a bit of a tension with the treatment of this, the building and trade suppliers, and that there appeared to be a level of inconsistency given the level of trade activity in the existing industrial zones. So it's almost like, why is it this just building and hardware home improvement stores are being treated differently from other trade stores such as micro bathrooms and electrical stores, which appear to be unable to locate in industrial zone land as we've seen currently have been drive. So I just thought they need to be careful not to get too inconsistent with the stuff in terms of the plan and its definition of retail. So is there anything that covers my evidence? So I had a little comfort around the submission of Bunnings and keep answering any questions.
Any questions? The thought that went through my mind, Heath is talking about this is a mixed planning, economic question or issue that you put on the table, that clearly a Bunnings warehouse looks like a warehouse, no doubt. Bunnings has paid architects a lot of money in order to ensure that their facilities look like warehouses, true to label.
I couldn't answer that question.
That, but do you, in terms of where they fit, it's probably It might be a little academic in Queenstown, which doesn't have heavy industry, but do you have, well, not that I've noticed, it's well hidden, do you have reverse sensitivity issues between what I would call your the Buttons operation, which is a hybrid retail trade supply, and what you might call more pure, what a purist would call industrial activities, and that, I've got to take your point that like some Mica bathrooms would have the same issue, potentially have the same issue. So I phrase this badly, but do you have reverse sensitivity issues with Bunnings warehouses in industrial zones?
From my perspective, I'll let Elizabeth deal with anything that she's aware of, but from my perspective, I'm unaware of any reverse sensitivity issues with Bunnings stores or other trade and building supply stores located in industrial zones. It seems to be an activity that is more complementary to industrial activity, particularly light industrial trade activity, because you see fewer and fewer real heavy, dirty, smoky, smelly, noisy type of industries establishing down the center of a dying breed in New Zealand. So I would expect to see more reverse sensitivity effects of trying to wedge this type of activity in more commercial environments rather than industrial environments, and as a result of truck and trailer movements, which reduces the level of amenity and the quality of environment and the whole experience, shopping experience of centres. So I'd anticipate to see more reverse sensitivity effects if these activities were located in commercial environments rather than industrial and Elizabeth may want to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't perceive reverse sensitivity being an issue for Bunnings located in these areas. I mean, I think in my time with the company I've come across.
Bunnings customers are not particularly sensitive.
Oh, they don't see red effects, we'd like to see.
It
does raise the urban form quality of industrial areas, though, in my experience, because you do get, obviously, a new building, which is often replacing older stock or older built form, and that newer building tends to improve the quality of the built form or stock of that particular, of any particular industrial area. Doesn't
it? Needs a more battered warehouse look.
If I could also interject, in the unitary plan process in Auckland, a similar question was raised by the heavy industry group that was presenting to the hearings panel up there. The suggestion was automotive sales and marine retail sales and trade suppliers could be adversely affected or could adversely affect heavy industry through reverse sensitivity. And that was canvassed extensively with a suggestion that those activities were thought to be restricted discretionary within 100 metres of the light of the heavy industry zone. Now, Bunnings challenged that, and the suggestion was, you know, as Mr. Heath has pointed out, you get fewer and fewer dirty industries, and if the only effect was going to be some dust on the nursery plants when they're outdoor, Bunnings was prepared to accept that as a potential effect locating in an industrial zone. They certainly weren't suggesting that they would locate in heavy industry zones in Auckland, so it was specific to light industry, where it's acknowledged that, in fact, you wouldn't be able to pollute or even apply for an air discharge consent to pollute in those locations. You have to find a heavy industry zone to do that.
So that's only in plants that have that distinction between heavy industry zones and light industry zones rather than a generic industrial zone.
As I say, it's probably academic, because if you wander around flats, there aren't any sort of, well, not any obvious heavy industry. So your answer would be that it would fit perfectly comfortably, your collective answer, it would be fit perfectly comfortably in the kind of industrial activities that are in fact found in the district.
It was a bit more comfortably in that environment rather than...
Sorry, I understand that. Yes, you made that point.
And I think there is potential for some conflict to occur in the mixed use thing, but I think that can be... That's not a deal breaker. That's just something that needs to be managed. And I suspect that would be in a master plan area of, say, three parks or...
And Ms. Panther Knight, what was the outcome on the AUP?
That's a good question. Certainly the automotive sales and the marine retail does require a strict discretionary activity within 100 metres of the heavy industry zone. I can't recall the outcome on transfer flights. I mean, I can understand it in respect of the others. Actually, I do recall now, I apologise. Marine retail, automotive sales and garden centres as a separate activity remain restricted discretion within 100 metres, but trade supplies are excluded from that separate control.
Great, we'll now hand over to Ms. Panther Knight.
And I confess my summary is somewhat moot now with the discussions that we've had this morning, so I won't rehash my evidence or go through that explanation. And in fact, I think the discussion has been very helpful in the motivation behind Bunnings' submission and trying to understand exactly how their activity will be treated in the district is clearly a tricky one and does need some consideration to get it right and so that it's clear. And the application of the plan is very smoothly. On that basis, I think that your suggestion, Mr. Chair, of looking at the trade supply definition in particular is probably the most appropriate. I say that because we can't yet confirm, in particular, what the industrial zone objectives and policies will be. And the reason I go there is my consideration is the industrial zone is the most appropriate location for a trade supply activity of Bunnings scale and nature and quality. So ideally, you would exclude the trade supplier definition from the definition of retail and specifically include it as an activity that's appropriate in the industrial zones through the objectives, policies and the zone provisions. We can't do that in this hearing, and leaving it to that position and excluding us from retail, as you've noted, leaves us potentially in no man's land. Having a look at the trade supplier, which is attempting to categorise a hybrid activity, is the most appropriate. Now, I've started drafting some comments, but I think it would be sensible and pragmatic if we could seek a little bit of time and perhaps come back to you with some wording on the trade supply definition. But I consider that would be the most appropriate approach to specifically define how trade suppliers are defined in the plan and then applied through the plan at a later date. The reason I say that, I think, is it allows us the opportunity to specifically identify how a trade supplier activity will be considered down the track relative to retail and industrial without messing too much with those definitions.
I'm perfectly happy for you to have time to think about it carefully and write it down and present it to us. The only constraint that I impose, we'd like it by about midday on Friday so that the council had enough time for giving their reply. Will we finish our hearings by that time?
Certainly. We would comply with that.
Can I inject into your thinking a thought that I had rereading your evidence at the definitions currently that you've taken from the Christchurch plan, the Auckland unitary plan of trade supplier and building supplier, and indeed the draft definition, they resonate to me that trade and building supply are the predominant activity. And I asked Ms. Davidson, and she rather fudged the response, whether that is the case for Bunnings, that it is the predominant supplier. I think there could be an argument that given the demographic profile of Queenstown with so many absentee landowners, that whatever the profile in Auckland, for instance, it would be different in Queenstown, and it might be more weighted to trade buyers than to DIYs. There might, you could, no doubt somebody could write a thesis about that. But in terms of, as you think about the definition of supplier, if the Bunnings situation, indeed the Mega Minor 10, would not or might not satisfy a predominant trade supply test, I think you want to be quite careful about how that implication, because, as I say, just rereading the Christchurch and Auckland definition, that was the impression I had, that retail is a subsidiary activity, maybe not ancillary, but certainly subsidiary, and that might not be, that might not quite work for you. That, I'd put it no higher than that.
So Justice Chisholm's decision in the High Court will be helpful.
My reading of trade supplier and building supplier definitions together, certainly that was my initial consideration, and when it was being promoted through the unitary plan, I raised concern with proportionality. The decision that Mr. Heath is referring to clearly went through the explanation of how these two definitions relate. And the important point is that building supplier doesn't limit proportion of what's being sold to whom, and that forms a subset of trade supplier, which does include the proportionality. So on the basis that Bunnings and other similar activities are clearly building suppliers, they are comfortably trade suppliers because they fall within that category when you come back to look at the trade supplier list of bullets. Now, I haven't clearly explained that, but what I'm saying is I'm comfortable that the proportionality identified in these two definitions does still include Bunnings activities.
Like what I'm really saying is that might have been a retrospective interpretation, but since we're in the business of doing the drafting, that we don't have... we have the freedom to say exactly what we mean, and not leave it to subsequent interpretation, which, however... You don't need to expose it to that level of uncertainty. We can call a spade a spade.
Sure.
Certainly, and that reinforces the need for us to go away and think about that carefully over the next couple of days to make sure that come lunchtime Friday you do have a definition or a solution proposed by us that does provide that clarity to all plan users.
And perhaps just to provide some guidance for your earlier point, and I cannot speak on behalf of Bunnings because I don't know exactly, but my experience with the compared to my 10 is that in my analysis that the proportional split would be starting to move into the realms of very similar to, if not slightly more, than the trade element to the retail element. So we're talking something meaningful in terms of the trade component of building
the harvest of poor. Well, I did, Ms. Davidson, and Justice say she'd fudged it.
Yeah.
Because she resisted the temptation to tell me whether it's more or less than 50%.
And that will change, obviously, store by store and market by market, depending on the level of competition.
And indeed, that was my point.
Yeah.
That whatever the position in Auckland, there is a case that could be made that Auckland, that Queenstown will be different. Queenstown is different at lots of levels,
and
that will be one.
And I agree with your point there. Probably the trade element here is likely to be slightly higher than what you see in all of the other markets. And more in the future given the construction move.
Great. Yes, well, on that basis, I won't ask the questions that I was going to ask. But I do know that in your evidence, you quoted the position of the Auckland Unitary Plan, and that clearly sets out trade suppliers as a subset of retail.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. And the nesting table approach in Auckland is unique to me. I hadn't seen it elsewhere, but what it does provide for is that specific and separate application through the provisions. And so if we were looking at this chapter of the proposed district plan against those provisions, then I'd be more comfortable accepting the point that trade supplies can be retail as long as they are appropriately addressed elsewhere. I think that the critical concern I have is that we don't yet know how they will be treated in the industrial zone, and I consider the industrial zone as the most appropriate location in this district, given the scarcity of land, for trade supply.
Presumably you'll have Bunnings advice on stage two.
I hope so.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that was effectively the case for Bunnings. I think to sum it up, it is about acknowledging that trade and building supplies aren't like other forms of retail, and there needs to be some unique treatment given to them. Now, the appropriate approach to provide that is something that we will need to consider over the next couple of days in light of the comments, because there are multiple ways that it could occur. You've seen, Mr. Chair, you mentioned with some of these other planning processes elsewhere in the country, there isn't a consistent way that they've been approached. The consistency is that they've all been dealt with in a unique basis, and they haven't been lumped in with all other forms of retail as far as when it comes to all the activity statuses and rules and things like that. And so that's the nub of Bunnings' case, that there does need to be some kind of unique treatment that recognises that these are quite apart from both traditional industrial activities, but equally all the normal forms of retail. And that's what we seek, is that through the plan that there is that recognition. And so we will go away and do some homework on whether there is an alternative way to achieve that. And we will come back to you later this week on that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The road goes on and on. Your road goes on and on.
Patience. And thank you for changing the time to fit into.
I tend to be out of here well before 1 o'clock, so maybe even easier. Three items on my list, commissioners. If I could start with Mount Cavanna Station Limited. I did lodge some legal submissions late last week. I know I could formally withdraw those legal submissions.
Right.
I was under a bit of pressure, and I took the definition in isolation and put that in. I took some time this morning to go back and read the rules framework around which the definition sits, and discovered that passenger systems, excluding buildings, are a controlled activity in the SA in the scary subzones. Buildings are a controlled activity in the scary subzones. Slight difference in assessment matters, not significant. So yes. NCL is actually quite happy with the council's approach on that issue.
Yes. Did you attend the hearings on the ski area subzone rules?
Yes.
Because I think there was a lot of discussion about that.
Yes.
At the time.
Yes.
So I did actually examine and discover that, in fact, Mount Pedrota Station wasn't notified of the definition part of the submission at that point, so it is appropriate.
I mean, I'm quite happy with it, sir, so
right, that's good.
I'll withdraw those submissions and move on. The second issue I'd like to address is the Hebburn Farm estate. Similar issue. It was about the definition of urban growth, which I put up quite a long way. Urban development, sorry.
Yes, well, just on that, before you start on that, Mr. Goldsmith, where in this definition of urban farms do they seek a definition of urban development?
The submission and find out.
I had to look, I couldn't find it. And the reason I ask is I wonder on what submission you're basing these submissions on.
Perhaps I've expressed the concern, Commissioners, and I think I can answer that question on the way through. It's to do with urban growth boundaries, urban development, urban growth boundaries, rezonings. As I summarised in my blue two-page submissions, there's an issue coming up in the rezoning debate, which we have yet to deal with, about the location of urban growth boundaries, about the zoning of land, and in particular the urban land, which you'll be aware of, issues relating to we have Jack's Point zoning, which is 95% open space and contains sensitive land in the village and the golf course and suburban development that's inside an urban growth boundary, whereas Arrowtown and Bilbra Waterfall Park have some very similar features and are not inside an urban growth boundary. There's a debate coming up on all of that, and my concern in reading that definition, it appeared to attempt to predetermine that debate by neatly redefining development in Millbrook and Waterfall Park as not being urban developed. Now, I'm not going to debate the merits of that. My concern was that, and I'm also conscious, and I did raise earlier the fact that we have issues being dealt with in three hearing streams, and you issued a minute making it clear that there's going to be a coming together of the minds in due course to resolve those issues, so I'm happy with that.
And I should tell you that the of all the commissioners who discussed this, probably Commissioner Robinson and I were the most involved in Stream 1A, that 1B. So you have the same people hearing this time.
My concern is more about to avoid a potentially inappropriate way that the rezoning debates get approached. That concern was reinforced this morning when I was reading the planning report for the ski area subzone hearing coming up, which includes the statement of, quote, "I wish to emphasise the Council's clear understanding that the rezoning hearing is not a second opportunity for submitters to debate the merits of the text for notified SASZ." And I'm not sure whether that statement's intended to refer to definitions, and in particular the definition of urban development. But it would be my understanding clearly that the panel can't have made any decisions yet on definitions. The Council has recommended that particular definition of urban development with its, what I think, funny second sentence. The rezoning debate that is coming up will challenge that. It will talk about urban growth boundaries and where they should be located, and in doing so we'll talk about what is urban and what isn't urban. We'll certainly challenge the fact that you can't just define, you can't remove urban development out of a debate by simply defining it out. You have to get there by another way, and I'm just concerned that when we come to that zoning debate, that the Council will take the view that that's the definition we're recommending. We're not here to relitigate that, therefore the Council people base their entire case on that definition, whereas my team could come along with a different basis for the case, and we end up with two arguments that kind of cross each other and don't meet each other, because the Council has decided that whatever you might call the development in Millbrook and Waterfall Park, zoned and existing, is not urban because of the definition. And we will be saying it is urban because it's urban. And I just want to make sure that we end up in the zoning debate with a substantive hearing where the two parties are actually meeting and debating the issue, and we don't have a miss because Council's relying on a definition which might say is beyond debate, and we'll be saying, well, it can't be on debate, there's been no decisions, it must be part of the debate. Now, I need to go back and figure out whether, because to make the urban farm estate limited submission talks about the location of the urban growth boundary. It talks about that there should be an urban growth boundary encompassing Arrowtown, Millbrook, Waterfall Park, and possibly Epping. So those issues will be on the table for debate. And just with, I would have thought, I could mount an argument that by implication, if you're going to define urban development in a way that beats that debate, then the definition of urban development must be on the table. I'm not going to have that debate now. I just wanted to make sure that the panel hearing this issue in the future may end up with two completely different cases. And the commissioners may want to communicate with the council staff about that, or end up two different cases. We do. I just wanted to put it on the table now rather than walk into a hearing and saying, well, we aren't even going to answer the council's case because they're on the definition we don't agree with. That's all.
Yes.
It's just a process. And I'm happy to just leave you with that, and if you wish to do something, you do or not, but I'm just, as I said, concerned that the council will base its case on that definition and we end up with two cases which don't meet in the middle somehow.
Well, in that case, then, yes. What was it you are suggesting?
Well, I'm quite happy at that point. Kim, I don't know where these definitions get finalised. It was being finalised in this hearing.
Well, no, that's the... to be fair, as a hearing panel, we have the same issue that, in fact, all of our recommendations, I think I said this in the mail today, issue in respect of one of your memorandums about 2 weeks ago, all our recommendations were made at council at the same time, so they will have to be internally consistent.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean that in hearing something in one panel, we can't reflect on what has been heard in another panel and discuss with the other panel whether things might need to be varied slightly, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, perhaps
if it's been put in stone until the council makes its decision on our recommendations, which places both yourself and the council in the same difficult position.
It does. I said it, I'm not going to go beyond my written submission in terms of that particular definition.
Right.
I've pointed out the inconsistency. I think it's a debate yet to be had. There's some consistencies to be done. There may come a point where, you define urban development before you determine the location of urban growth boundaries, or you determine the location of urban growth boundaries and then decide.
I think I put that in terms of Jack's point, I think I should tell you that we did have submissions, and I can't remember who it was from, but I think it may well be Mr. Bragan, that in fact, in Jack's point, the urban area should be limited to that which is residential and village, and the rest should not be within the urban growth boundaries. And I did ask the council officers about why the urban growth boundaries was around the entire zone and included an area of obvious outstanding natural landscape, and they didn't really have an answer to that question. So I don't think that you can necessarily use Jack's point as an example.
Well, I'm going to use Jack's point as an example of the apparent inconsistency in the plan as notified between two different factual situations. And at the end of the day, whether they both change or whatever, I'm sure the panel will be seeking to come out with a consistent outcome. So as it stands, as notified, there appears to be an inconsistency which has to be dealt with.
Yes.
And it's the next hearing that deals with the boundaries, as I understand it.
Yes. And accepting Jack's point.
Okay, well,
at least because it's part of the... outline development panel, concept plan, whatever it's called. But, yes.
I don't know where the crossover is between the urban growth boundaries and the resort zone hearing, but I believe that's you. Anyway, that's what I wish to say on that, Commissioners. Just one of the questions.
I would counsel Mr. Goldsmith that he could perhaps read the Millbrook submission. You might find that they have a submission specifically on the definition of urban development that seeks that they be excluded.
Interesting. I appreciate the comment. Yeah.
issue. Mr. Gordon's submissions that he presented to us went into some detail on that.
Yes. Depressingly, I think it's almost exactly a year ago.
That's that one. And finally, Arcadian Triangle Limited, and I had previously acknowledged to the panel that Arcadian Triangle Limited is a company of mine that I use to as a vehicle to raise little issues with the district plan that I think should be raised.
And so we move from legal submissions to evidence.
No, that's the legal submission. I expressed concern, and I'm addressing the issue of default status of activities in the district plan. The submission lodged by Arcadia is submitted that the current default status for activities not otherwise specified is permitted, and that none of the Section 32 documentation has identified any concern over the past 20 or 25 odd years about that approach, and that approach should be continued into the current plan. That has been addressed in the report prepared on entire plans and general comments. Issue 6, on page 15. And all I want to do, Commissioners, is go through verbally the rationale given here for the notified approach being supported in this report, and just identify some comments which I believe are relevant to it. Page 15, issue 11, it's issue 6, paragraphs 11.1 and following. 11.1 quotes the Arcadian submission. 11.2 comments that there is actually a difference in the district plan. Some zones the default is permitted, some zones the default is non-compliant. 11.2 identifies that in Waterfall Park the default is non-compliant, whereas in Millbrook right next door the default is permitted. Jack's Point, the default is permitted. Jack's Point Zone, which includes large areas of land, including significant areas of ONL, which is zoned ONLWB under the proposed plan, has a default status of permitted. How one can differentiate between Millbrook and the immediately adjoining Waterfall Park and justify a different default status between those two zones is not explained, and I just raise a question mark about that. I raise a question mark about the permitted default status in Jack's Point and the rural general land across the other side of the highway is non-compliant default status. Seems inconsistent. Paragraph 11.3, there's a reference to the rural chapters here, and the statement is made that in the rural zone any activity not identified should be a non-compliant activity. I consider this method provides certainty to plan users in terms of the outcome sought. I struggle with that statement. Provides certainty that the activity is non-compliant. How that provides certainty to plan users other than the fact that the default status is non-compliant is difficult to understand. And it goes on to say the ODP is structured on the presumption that activities not otherwise specified are permitted, and I consider this makes the ODP rural general zone in particular cumbersome and complicated. Now, with respect to the report writer, it is not the default activity status which makes the current plan cumbersome and complicated. It's the sieve status whereby you have to go through A, B, C, D, E, and whatever drops out is permitted. That plan structure is cumbersome, and that's been fixed in the new plan. But that is different from the default status. How you get to the default status is one thing, and I agree that the current plan with its schedule of activities and everything else makes it very easy to get to activities not otherwise covered. But that doesn't justify a default status of non-compliant. The plan structure has been fixed. That's completely irrelevant to whether default status should be non-compliant or permitted. Then in paragraph 11.4, the statement is further reinforced by the discussion and examples of the activity status of activities in paragraphs 9.9 to 9.12. Now, that's the only substantive rationale given for the default status of non-compliant. I turn to paragraphs 9.9 to 9.12 referred to. And 9.9, second sentence, in particular, a non-compliant activity status is often used for activities that are not contemplated within the zone. This activity status is preferred in these instances because it requires applications to be considered in terms of 104, and that is considered appropriate to ensure the effects of land uses are not complicated, are suitably interrogated through the resource consent process. With respect to the import right, again, non-compliant activity status is a status given to activities which are not anticipated to occur in the zone due to their identified adverse effects. I raise the question as to how you can apply non-compliant activity status to an activity you haven't even thought of.
Isn't that the same thing? If you haven't thought of it, you can't have anticipated it.
Well, I accept that, sir, but Section 9 of the Act, which starts off with you can do with your land as you want unless there's an environmental reason to stop you doing it, I would argue that is the starting point. If a Section 32 analysis relating to an activity arrives at a conclusion by looking at the effects and the nature of the activity, and the effects of the activity arrives at a conclusion, the activity should be strongly discouraged. But then,
if you haven't anticipated it, how can you do a Section 32 analysis of the effects?
Well, if you haven't anticipated, you can't, commissioners, and therefore, in my submission, you can't arrive.
Wasn't that the point, though, of Section 114, to enable you to do that for those things that you haven't anticipated, because they may be consistent with the objectives and policies and plan, as it turns out, and therefore can then be perceived to be considered. Well, they may have, having considered the effects, be of such a state that they shouldn't be considered. You know, that's the whole point, isn't it, of Section 104D, to enable you to do that essential test for those things that haven't been thought of.
My argument, Commissioner, is that by applying a non-compliant activity status, you are making a predetermination without knowing what the activity is and what the effects are, that it is not anticipated by the plan and shouldn't occur in that zone. That's what non-compliant activity status does. But that would be different. It would be different if I can just carry on this. If I go back to when the RMA first came in, we had that weird room, the nominate activities, the ones that fell into the cracks, and there was a default provision in the Act that said nominate activities are discretionary.
Well, there was nothing actually in the Act.
Hmm?
There was nothing. That came in as on an amendment, the nominate activity.
Ah, right.
Yeah, there was nothing, and what fell into the cracks tended to be in the coastal marine area, where consents were required, but there was nothing in transitional plans, because there weren't transitional plans.
Correct.
And there were occasional instances. But I think
the point I made is
the argument you're making there seems inconsistent, because what you're saying is the submission is to make them permitted. Well, if you haven't anticipated it, why would you make them permitted?
Which is why I was going to my point about going back to the back of the day. My first point is that there is no justification for the non-compliant activity status because it hasn't been assessed. My second point, if there is to be a default status, and given that, again, we have a plan here where in some zones apparently it's fine to have the permitted activity status, in other zones it isn't, which seems inconsistent and strange. If there has to be a catch-all, then surely the peripheral catch-all would be discretionary, not non-compliant, because then at least discretionary enables the full assessment of the effects and objectives of policies, but doesn't create the non-compliant activity hurdle of A, not contrary to policy objectives, B, adverse effects are no more than minor, C, doesn't set a precedent, which is another issue, because it could be an acceptable activity, but you might fail because it sets precedent.
But your C is not in the Act.
It's not in the Act, but it is in the way the non-compliant activity status is applied by case law.
Well, precedent can also apply on discretionary activities too.
It could do.
So I don't see
it. It could do, but it's kind of unusual. Yeah. Well, and if it's a bad precedent, fine. But it's.
Yeah. I'm a bit lost because the fact that something is discretionary is not, in the case law, give it an easier pathway if it's problematic. Section 104D merely enables some filtering before one goes on to the section 104 analysis. I'm not sure that it's really the issue that you raise if you're now seeking that it be discretionary.
Well, you still have to get through the non-compliant activity here.
Well, isn't that a filtering process?
It's a very,
comply with one or the other.
It's a very strong filtering process. It's a very tough filtering process. And again, when it comes to case law, you end up with issues of precedent as well.
But if it were to be discretionary and you were contrary to the objectives and policies on the plan, isn't there every likelihood of being declined in any of them?
It depends how the objectives and policies you're contrary to. I mean, it's an even-handed approach that can have a range of outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
As in this district, where all development in the rural general zone is discretionary, and you end up with a range of outcomes. Non-complying is still a higher percentage. In reality, and in the way planners write reports, and in all sorts of ways, non-complying is a higher percentage. I'll go back to the point. I'll just finish off with really, which I'm just going to come to, is that regime has been in place for however long it's been in place. I'm not aware of the council staff identifying with the two issues I'm going to comment on now, any past problem. And the two issues that are raised in paragraph 9-11, the two examples of where this has apparently been a problem in the past, second half of 9-11 talks about, for these unspecified activities, the only rule that applies is rule 53512, scale and nature, that restricts activities other than farming, factory farming, forestry, residential, 100 square metre gross floor area, no goods, materials or equipment stored outside, etc. 9-12 gives two examples. Activities such as a civil constructor's yard are permitted in the ODP. Well, I don't know how you get a civil constructor's yard permitted in the ODP when you have a scale and nature of activity that says no goods, materials or equipment can be stored outside the building. Because contractors' yards store materials, goods and equipment. So for it to be permitted, it would have to be inside the building. And the scale and nature of activity says you can't have a building bigger than 100 square metres, everything must be inside. So I'm just identifying the fact that that example given in my submission doesn't provide a basis. And the second example given is industrial activities. I acknowledge they're permitted. If they're fully inside a building, no bigger than 100 square metres, and they comply with the noise standard. It's a very thin justification. And in any event, in the second sentence of 9-12, both those particular issues have been addressed by making them non-compliant. So under the new plan, we appear to have identified two possible problems in the past. I don't accept that they're problems, but that there's any evidence of them being a problem, but in any event, they've been fixed. So 20 years, no problem, we suddenly change to quite a tough regime. I just raise the point, to me it's a matter of principles, how you can justify non-compliant on that basis. At worst, discretion, if not permitted.
I wasn't sure. Are you changing the relief to discretionary, or?
I'm alerting you to, sir, between the relief request of the permitted and the status of non-complying, there's a range.
Right.
I maintain my case for permitted.
Right.
Okay. It would be irresponsible for me not to alert you to a possible midpoint.
Okay. Any questions?
There's a trend to make things hard with the RMA. Every time plans come out, they seem to get harder and harder and harder and more and more rules. My submission is in part a reaction against that.
Yesterday, Mr. Goldsmith, I asked Mr. Barr the question as to how real that permitted activity status was, because I think that I was involved in the subdivision hearing when we had a debate about, or discussion, I wouldn't say debate, a discussion as to how real the default control status for subdivisions was in practice. And Mr. Barr's response, having pondered the scale and degree issue, was that he thought that for non-farming activities in the rural general zone, because of the scale and degree requirement, it was pretty unreal, almost illusory that the default was discretionary. Now, putting your evidential hat on, do you disagree with that view?
I don't disagree with it, and on the basis that I looked back over 20 years and I'm not sure I can recollect any example applied occurring in the past. Doesn't mean to say it mightn't happen somewhere, but it seems to me to be unlikely, if not highly unlikely.
Well, just to be clear, the proposition that I put to Mr. Barr, what is illusory is that activities would in fact be considered to be permitted and wouldn't need a consent. Like, yes, it's written in the plan, but how many examples would actually apply? And his view was that for non-farming activities in the rural general zone, very few. And I suppose that's what I'm inviting you to agree or disagree with.
I would agree with that. I'm trying to think of a potential activity that can get inside the scale and nature. As I said, there's a building no bigger than 100 square metres. You can't do anything outside. You've got to comply with the noise standard.
And there's a limit to the number of people that can be employed.
There's a limit to the number of people that can be employed on site. So
it's a bit like, I've always had difficulty establishing what the baseline is in the rural general zone, because in reality, when you start to analyse it, there isn't a permitted baseline.
Because nothing's permitted
except for farming.
It is unlikely.
Yes.
I wasn't more reacting than I said to you. It's a matter of almost kind of, everything seems to, the reactions to make things harder and make the hurdles higher. So we just go from permitted to non-complying and couldn't really see the justification.
All your questions?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith.
That was it.
Thank you. I will do it all.